My father is friends with Garrett's dad, although he avoids telling me any interesting secrets, Wade said, and I could sense he felt sorry for Garrett, in a way. There was probably more to this story, but I was too tired and shaken to pursue it further. Dinner first, then hot shower, then sleep. Maybe 5 more minutes and our food would be ready. I could already smell the fried rice from the kitchen. So, about the points system, I said, trying to sort the various questions in my mind by order of importance. If we manage to increase our score by the end of this year, it'll pave the way for next year's efforts. Once we start getting the bonuses, the other covens won't look down on us anymore, Wade said. The bottom line is that this coven deserves better funding. Our magicals are good people, just jaded and undervalued. How does the scoring work, though? I asked. What's the criteria? Save a cat from a tree, get 10 points, park illegally, lose 5? He smirked. Something like that. The greater the deed, the higher the number of points awarded to the coven. We run a number of missions, mostly focused on discovering and registering new magicals, educating the ones we get in, maintaining the secrecy of our society, and helping humans when rogue magicals attempt to hurt or influence their world. How would a magical influence the human world? I mean, other than standing on top of the Empire State Building and announcing a new world order. Some sneak into government and military positions. Out of all the spells and potions we've gathered over eons, the one thing we don't have is a magical detector of sorts. We rely on investigation and observation. We cannot feel other magicals. If you put a magical in a room full of people, he won't be able to point out other magicals unless he pays attention and catches them while performing spells. I hold hope that someday we will come up with such a spell. But until then, it's good old-fashioned detective work for the covens to identify new magicals. To be honest, most of the time it's easy. As children, we have little to no control over our abilities. Accidents happen. What about Adley de la Barte? She did that reading on me. Can't you work on mainstreaming that particular process? She is working on something, but the reading requires the subject's consent. You were reluctant, for example, but eventually allowed her to read your blood. If you were to adamantly say no, she wouldn't have been able to see a thing. She's researching ways to bypass that, but it takes time and plenty of tests. With sufficient funding, Adley might find a detection method within the next decade. The bell above the main entrance door jingled, prompting both Wade and me to turn our heads. To my surprise, and based on what I was feeling, Wade's too, Garrett walked in. He was absently swiping through his phone as he headed toward the counter. He looked up, his lips stretching into a grin as he saw us. Crap. Wade watched as Garrett made his way between several tables to stop by ours first. Only then did I notice sadness somewhere deep inside him. Using logic and the information I'd gathered so far, I understood why. Their dads were friends. It stood to reason that Wade and Garrett had once been friends too. Something had clearly changed to put them at such opposite poles now. Something Wade felt sorry about.
Funny running into you two here, Garrett said, though he didn't sound amused.
I really disliked not being able to feel him. He narrowed his eyes at Wade.
I see you didn't waste any time trying to get into the new girl's pants.
Watch your mouth, Garrett. This is human territory and you don't want to set her off.
Wade warned him, and I wasn't sure whether I should feel flattered or offended. For the first time ever, and much to my surprise, I decided to keep my mouth shut and watch their dynamic unfold.
So what? I'm not interrupting a date?
Garrett raised an eyebrow at me. I simply shook my head in response, ignoring the flames in my cheeks. My stomach tightened. But that wasn't me. That was Wade.
No, we're just waiting for food, Wade replied. I'm guessing you haven't heard yet.
Heard what?
Garrett frowned, his gaze darting between Wade and me.
There was another gargoyle attack, Wade said. 3 of them came after Harley in her apartment.
I showed him the smoky jar on the table next to the condiments basket. His jaw nearly dropped.
his eyes wide with shock. "Only one made it," I added. "We had to kill the other two before they hurt people."
"Are you okay?"
Garrett looked at me, sounding concerned. I didn't see that coming, so all I managed to think of in response was a shrug. He then scowled at Wade.
"Why wasn't I notified?"
"I don't know," Wade replied, slightly amused.
"I texted Alton about it. He decides who is privy to this information."
"And you didn't think to call me, too? You know, since I'm leading the investigative team? Or are you that jealous that you're willing to sabotage the actual investigation just to spite me?"
Garrett spat. "Tone it down, Sherlock. I'm sure Alton will call you soon enough," Wade said.
His fingers tapped the wooden surface of the table in no particular rhythm, but his rings were giving off a faint, warm, white glow. I wasn't sure what that meant, given how little I knew about an esprit, but I had trouble looking away. The delicate light cast elegant shadows over his long piano player fingers.
"It happened less than half an hour ago."
As if summoned, Garrett's phone rang, and I caught a glimpse of Alton's name on the screen before he picked up.
"Yes, sir."
"Sir?" I mouthed, looking at Wade with slight confusion. Garrett had been quite disrespectful earlier during the assembly, so "sir" sounded alien coming out of his mouth. Wade stifled a grin as he patiently waited for Garrett to finish his phone call. I found myself fascinated by the fine line forming at the corner of Wade's mouth whenever he smiled. He didn't have Garrett's dimpled cuteness. There was something more mature and masculine about his expression. I shook the thought out of my head, then shifted my focus back to Garrett, who was still listening to Alton's instructions.
"Yes, sir, I'll do that then," he replied,
then hung up and gave us both a sheepish smile, dimples and all.
"So yeah, I've just been informed there was a gargoyle attack at Park West. I trust you'll have the full report ready tonight, Crowley. It might come as a shock to you, but some of us actually do our jobs in this coven. So yes, Garrett, you'll get your report in a couple of hours, tops. I just need to debrief Harley,"
Wade replied bluntly.
"No need. I can debrief her,"
Garrett retorted, then gave me another one of those winks that I didn't quite get.
"Over drinks later? There's a great bar just around the corner from the Science Center. Ditch this loser first, though," he added, nodding at Wade.
"You're just a bundle of messed up, dysfunctional crazy, aren't you?" I said in response, befuddled by his contradictory remarks. Did he hate me? Or was he asking me out? Not being able to feel his emotions made it very difficult for me to ascertain his true intentions.
"Probably, but you're gorgeous, and I'd like to take you out for a drink. Hopefully you'll give me a chance to apologize for being a jerk earlier,"
Garrett replied, putting on a charming smile. And it was working. Why was it working? I looked at Wade, and anger poured through my veins. A couple minutes more of this, and I feared I'd end up breaking up a fight between these two.
"That's very nice and unexpected of you," I mumbled. "But I think we should..."
"You either debrief us both, or I debrief her and give you my notes, along with my account of the event,"
Wade replied, his voice low and cold enough to send chills down my spine.
"Either works, provided you wish to prove to Alton that you're a professional and not busy chasing skirts."
"Whoa," I gasped, my face flushed. Tension crackled between them, and somehow I was caught in the middle of it. However, I didn't take kindly to being called a skirt, especially not in that bubbling sea of testosterone. And I had a bad habit of making rash decisions on impulse when annoyed, which didn't even begin to cover my state at that point. Given that we were in a public space and I'd already drawn enough attention to myself earlier while jumping out the window of my apartment, a more discreet solution to end this ridiculous standoff was needed.
"You know what?"
I said, suddenly enlightened. "No one's getting into my pants, and no one's chasing this skirt either."
"Garrett?"
"Sure, I'll go out for a drink with you. But not tonight. It's been a long freaking day, and I just need to sleep after I eat."
"Wait. You need to debrief me tonight, and I need to stuff my face with spring rolls and fried rice. So, let's get moving."
I stood,
pointing at the restaurant counter where our order had just been bagged. "Food's ready." I then walked over to the clerk, who smiled at us as he handed over the food. Wade followed, without saying anything, but I could feel the shame and anger boiling inside him. He knew he'd messed up, his mouth talking without him. But he couldn't concede in front of Garrett. He was probably saving the apology for later. We left Garrett, who was staring at me with a mixture of shock and amusement, behind. If I didn't know any better, I would have said he was impressed, somehow. Maybe other girls just swooned over him and tolerated his snappy retorts, but I had no intention of giving him the satisfaction. The main reason I'd accepted his invitation for drinks was to try and gather some intel from the investigative team. I had a personal interest in the gargoyles now. I also wanted to annoy Wade a little for referring to me as a skirt, and that had worked like a charm. At the same time, I requested that Wade debrief me because I wanted to hit Garrett where it hurt most, in the investigative team. If my assumptions about him were correct, he'd yet to realize that sure, he got to go out with me, but missed out on the opportunity to debrief me in an official capacity. Guess Mrs. Smith was right. Men can only think with one brain at a time.
"You have the makings of a deviant," Wade said, in a low tone as we stepped outside, and I passed him the food bags in return for the jar.
He knew exactly what I'd done, and I didn't know whether I should fear future retaliation or take it as a compliment. Wade could be very confusing.
"I don't know what you're talking about," I said, keeping my eyes on the road ahead. The sound of cars driving by hurt my very soul as I remembered the state of my Daisy back at Park West. I'd worked hard to get her in driving shape. I bought her from a second-hand dealership, and she was barely running at the time, choking whenever I switched gears. All it took was one big-ass, vengeful gargoyle to render her useless. Wade's Jeep was parked just another block ahead, between two bland sedans. There was no sign of its scuffle with the gargoyle back at the casino. Good mechanic. It stood out like a black metal giant, which seemed emblematic of Wade's personality somehow. I stole a glance at him, just as he turned his head to steal one at me, and our eyes met for an awkward second.
"Come on, get in," Wade said, looking away, suddenly cold and distant.
He clicked his key fob, and the Jeep let out a double beep, its doors unlocking. "We still have a lot to do before tomorrow." "Can I eat in the car?" I asked, my stomach pulling at my sleeve. He scowled at me as we got in.
"Would you let anyone eat in your car?"
I thought about it, and he was right. I would have blown a fuse if someone wanted to eat hot Chinese food in my Daisy. "Sorry, never mind," I said, looking down. "But you'll have to put up with my stomach growling louder than a gargoyle."
"That's cool," Wade replied,
then turned the radio on and the volume up. A heavy metal song blared through the speakers. Yeah, my stomach didn't stand a chance with that noise. I gave Wade another sideways glance and noticed the muscle twitching in his jaw as he twisted his key in the ignition. He was definitely annoyed, maybe even upset. I understood then that the deviant part wasn't meant as a compliment. I'd upset him by choosing to go out with Garrett, but he was conflicted because I'd also given him the task of my debriefing. And he really didn't like being conflicted.
"Can you try and turn the empathy off when I'm around?"
From the sound of his voice, he was also still irritated by my ability. He couldn't hide from me. I almost felt sorry for him, while stifling a grin as I pressed my lips tight. "I usually do, but I can't shut it off entirely. I still get whiffs of emotions here and there. But my system's all upside down after the assembly today. I need to sleep it off."
"I kindly ask that you try, nonetheless. It's extremely uncomfortable to be around you otherwise."
"Oh. Ouch." Yeah, I pushed the wrong buttons on the guy. Did I feel sorry, though? Or did I find his anguish amusing? Food for thought. Right after the spring rolls and fried rice. Chapter 17. After I'd scarfed down my Chinese dinner while Wade debriefed me, Santana took me to my room. She'd kicked another magical out of there to get me in,
The guy hadn't even had a chance to take down all his movie posters, and he'd also left his toothbrush and shaving cream behind. After a hot shower, I sank into the memory foam bed, expecting to quickly drift into deep sleep. I didn't. Instead, I tossed and turned, my eyes popping open every 5 minutes. My brain was too busy processing everything that had happened, from the moment I'd first seen Wade down to Garrett's flirtatious wink as he asked me out earlier. In between, snippets of preceptors, readings, Finch's flight across the cafeteria hall, and the gargoyles kept bothering me, each carrying question marks and warning signs. If the bestiary was so secure, how come monsters kept slipping out? How did the same gargoyle manage to escape twice? If the boxes were so amazing and super charmed, how did that creature outsmart them? Or did it? What if it was an inside job? Was someone from the San Diego Coven trying to stir it all up? What was their endgame? Oh, I am not prepared for any of this. I sat up with a frustrated huff, disliking the darkness that had settled around me. The windows showed me the outside world as they overlooked the park. The circular fountain was somewhere farther to the left, and there was no moon out tonight, just stars and strips of clouds. Clearly, I wasn't going to get any sleep, not after everything that had happened. My heart was still aching over Daisy, and over the fact that I couldn't enjoy my own place anymore. If one gargoyle had made it out twice, and brought two more with him to hunt me down, chances were that there could be a third attack, if the bestiary was still vulnerable. Remembering the Mage Council's warning, I couldn't help but worry about Alton, Wade, and all the other magicals, especially my rag team. Not that I was emotionally attached or anything, but still, I felt bad for them. If they lost points on this, chances were that Adley's research was going to suffer. Like it or not, for the next month, the coven is your concern, too. I slipped into my jeans and t-shirt, then went for a walk through the coven, looking for the bestiary. It was a little after midnight, and barely a handful of witches and warlocks were still out at this time. I couldn't remember the exact route that Alton had taken to get to the bestiary, not that there would be signs pointing to the most dangerous place on Earth anyway. So I wandered through the hallways for a while, gawking at bronze dragons along the way. I caught a glimpse of a familiar corridor to my left, so I went through, remembering how the walls closed in on me as we got closer to the bestiary. 15 minutes later, I was standing at the end of the distorted hallway, fitted around the tall, oval door. I didn't see any of the extra security yet, and figured they'd yet to start their shift. I turned the knob, but the door was locked. It made sense, though. I wouldn't keep a terrarium full of poisonous spiders and deadly snakes without a lid. I wonder. Aperi portam, I whispered. It was a shot in the dark, but a shot nonetheless. And a good one, it seemed, as I heard the locking mechanism click. I turned the knob again, and the door opened with a subtle creak. The lights were mostly off, except for the wall sconces that still flickered quietly, casting a warm glow over the crystal boxes filled with formless, smoky monsters. I wasn't sure what I was doing here, but I figured I could at least take a better look at those rune locks and glass casings. Maybe I'd see something the others had missed. Thinking a little too highly of yourself there. I walked through the narrow corridors with walls made of monster boxes in different sizes. My skin crawled as I felt countless pairs of eyes watching me. I heard voices somewhere to my right, so I slowly and quietly made my way to the source. Two figures stood beyond a massive glass box with tropical greenery and a plethora of dark limestone rocks. It looked familiar, but I didn't give it a second thought, crouching by its side so I could get a better look at the two figures, one particularly massive, which I identified as Tobe, and one whose soft, honey-like voice instantly reminded me of Alton. I leaned forward, my face against the glass, until I could see both clearly.
I don't think we should keep the Mage Council out of this, Alton. It's too risky.
As suspected, Tobe and Alton were engaged in what sounded like a heavy conversation. I listened quietly, ignoring the goosebumps I was getting from the monster's attention.
They couldn't do anything while stuck in those glass boxes anyway.
Right now, only you, me, and Garrett's and Wade's teams know about this, Alton replied. You heard Leonidas today. One more slip-up and they'll start handing out the penalties.
And you'll lose what, money bonuses? Is that worth putting this coven's magicals at risk?
Tobe said, crossing his feathered arms.
We can handle this on our own, Tobe. All the council can do is look down at us and deprive us of future funding. And Adley's getting so close to a fully functional detector.
We can't risk it.
No one got hurt, and we can clean this up before any rumor makes it back to the council. You know they'll put some blame on you, too. Leonidas will stop at nothing to make us look like idiots.
My Daisy got hurt.
Leonidas will die one day of old age, and I will still be here. I have seen plenty of his kind, and I am not intimidated,
Tobe declared, and pride flowed through me like liquid fire.
Nor do I expect you to be intimidated, Tobe, but you must understand that the times are changing. They all expected us to turn down the nomination, and the Covens have been laughing at us for too long,
Alton insisted.
One more push with Adley, and we'll prove our worth. Whatever problems we're having with the bestiary, we can handle them on our own. We don't need the council holding our hands and humiliating us further.
What do you suggest we do then?
Let's start by doing another sweep of the bestiary tomorrow. I'll have Garrett and his magicals do a thorough search of every box, every lock, and every mechanism,
Alton proposed.
Wade and the rag team will handle the cleanup, and I'll send out more magicals to search for rogues. Those two wild gargoyles came from the San Diego area for sure.
What if others escape from the bestiary? What then? What if someone gets killed?
Tobe frowned.
I've been around for over 1,000 years, Alton, and this has never happened before. It's completely unprecedented, and I'm worried for the safety of this coven.
So what? Do we tremble in our boots and expect the Mage Council to solve something we can handle ourselves?
Alton replied.
Listen, if it gets worse, I will notify the council. In the meantime, let's reinforce security and investigate this properly. I'll give you some of Nomura's instructors to help around the bestiary, particularly when you're resting. I'd advise you not to leave here for a while. O'Halloran can do live monster training with the new recruits. He's fought most of the creatures in here already.
Tobe shook his head slowly, his thick mane rippling in soft golden waves.
The monsters only listen to me, and me alone. The only thing that added security can do is alert me and try to catch them in mason jars.
The more the better, I say. At least we'll know we've tried everything. And I'll ask Sloane to devise more charms for the boxes, too, just to be on the safe side. I'll restrict access to the bestiary as well. Whatever I can do to ease your mind that doesn't involve calling the council, I'll do it, Tobe. Just bear with me. And I know we'll get to the bottom of it.
I've locked Murray in a separate box,
Tobe said, scratching the back of his head.
You named that gargoyle Murray?
Alton chuckled.
Letters and numbers don't do these creatures justice. Besides, getting out of the bestiary twice and going after Harley just for revenge has made him stand out.
Tobe shrugged.
So I called him Murray. He sounds like a Murray.
That ugly winged bastard responsible for the destruction of my Daisy did sound like a Murray indeed. I knew a bully in kindergarten named Murray. He used to eat glue, blame me for it, then put chewing gum in my hair. My first foster mom had to cut my hair short because of bird-brained Murray. Yeah, Murray sounds about right.
I'd advise you to keep an eye on the kids tonight,
Alton concluded.
I'll come by in the morning and we can discuss this further then. Trust me, Tobe. Once we figure out what the problem is, we'll be able to resolve it without any council involvement. I can't simply flush 2 years' worth of Adley's research down the drain because of this. You know full well that if we nail one of those bonuses, I'll be sure to upgrade central parts of the bestiary, too.
Agreed,
Tobe replied.
We do need special replacement parts for the stem to amplify the energy output to African and Southeast Asian covens.
All the more reason for you to stick with me on this one, Tobe.
Alton smiled, then gently patted his shoulder.
I'll see you in the morning, friend.
Tobe gave him a brief nod, and we both watched him leave. As I turned my head to follow him from the other side of the glass box, I froze at the sight of two huge turquoise eyes with black slits in the middle that took center stage in front of me. I quickly recognized the white and fuchsia plumage of his collar. Quetzalcoatl, the massive snake, stared at me from inside its glass box, the same box I'd chosen to hide behind. Its jaws snapped open, and it hissed violently, its feathers trembling aggressively. Chills ran through me as I jumped back on pure instinct, catching Tobe's attention. He didn't seem mad, but rather amused.
I think Ketsy likes you, he quipped, as I stood up straight, ignoring the waves of adrenaline surging through me.
It was a natural response to having just 2 inches of glass stand between me and a giant, monstrous snake that could gobble me up in seconds. I looked down at the creature. Just as it lifted, then cocked its head to one side, its haws flicking back over its gem-like eyes. Again, I wasn't sure whether that was cute or creepy.
Sorry, Tobe, I murmured, putting on my most innocent expression. I didn't mean to eavesdrop on you and Alton.
What are you doing here? You should be resting after such an eventful day.
I couldn't sleep, I shrugged. I just wanted to look around, maybe see if I could find something to help with the investigation. As of tonight, this whole bestiary issue got really personal really fast.
Don't worry about it, Harley, he replied gently. We'll take care of it. But as I assume you heard what Alton said, keep the incident to yourself and your team. No one else can know, at least for now.
I nodded, putting my hands in my pockets. I was still very restless. I won't tell, of course. But how do you think the gargoyle escaped the second time around? I thought you guys checked and secured the boxes already.
We did, and that's what bothers me the most. There are approximately 2,000 gargoyles in the bestiary. They're the most frequent purge manifestations, and they tend to team up in packs. Murray came out and rallied 2 wild ones to join him, for example. I fear that if another comes out, it will do the same. Or worse.
Tobe sighed, then gazed across to his left, through several walls of glass boxes, where black smoke swirled around, as if responding to his attention.
I'm afraid we might be dealing with an inside job. And I don't like how it's making me look incompetent. I never had such issues with my monsters before. They all fear me and obey me without exception. And yet Murray keeps getting out. And I fear others might follow his example.
That confirmed one of my suspicions. At least I knew my reasoning wasn't faulty on this one. But the follow-up question still bothered me.
Why would anyone try to sabotage the bestiary? What would their purpose be? I asked.
I'm not sure, but I do know Alton drew the ire of many covens when he didn't reject the nomination for the bestiary. The Los Angeles and San Francisco covens in particular are still fuming, as they consider San Diego to be woefully inferior and unprepared for such a task.
And what do you think, Tobe? You've been the Beastmaster since its inception. Surely you've seen worse covens than this, I replied, the corner of my mouth twitching. Tobe needed a couple of seconds to answer that. It didn't work in San Diego's favor.
I don't know, honestly, he replied. On one hand, there is so much potential in the magicals here. But at the same time, due to poor funding and low morale prior to Alton's arrival, they have so much to catch up on compared with other covens.
Potential? I asked. You see potential here. I'm told a substantial amount of magicals in the San Diego Coven are mediocre. Like me.
But that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Tobe smiled.
Personally, I find the label to be quite elitist. And I don't think it cancels out the tremendous potential of every magical in this place. They simply need more confidence in their own abilities. They lack motivation. Alton is doing a fine job, and he'll probably make more progress in the years to come. But even he is too deeply attached to the rules and regulations. This whole mediocre concept is completely unnecessary, if you ask me. And yet magicals in positions of power often use it to deny other magicals the possibility of advancement in the coven ranks.
That's cruel and foolish, I said, my dislike for the magical society swelling in my throat like a painful lump. Would I pledge my life and services to a coven that was so quick to slap me with the mediocre label? Would I ever be given the chance to evolve beyond that?
Tell me, Harley. Do you agree with your mediocrity?
Tobe replied, as if reading my mind. Something Wade seemed good at, too. For a split second, I wondered what Wade was up to right now. Probably snoring his butt off. But Tobe asked a good question. Was I okay with being classified as a mediocre? My ego screamed, hell no, and my instincts also disagreed. I shook my head in response. Not really, no. It's not just because of the reading, though. I mean, sure, it does sound ridiculous to be a full elemental and an empath and a telekinetic and be deemed a mediocre. And I'm just using common reasoning here, no magical knowledge whatsoever. But there's also something deep down, like this little voice in the back of my head. And it's telling me I'm not mediocre at all. It's almost laughing at the prospect. I feel like I can be more and better. Tobe nodded slowly, carefully considering my answer, then took a couple of steps forward. He was so tall that I had to tilt my head back a little.
You see, in circumstances such as yours, having some information about your birth parents would have been very useful. Parental heritage often determines a magical's prospects, including the chances of being labeled a mediocre. Do you know anything about your biological family?
Nothing whatsoever. I sighed, then remembered the note from my father, still stuck in the back pocket of my jeans. I took it out, then handed it over to him. All I have is this note from my father. I was 3 years old when I was left at the orphanage. Nobody knows how I ended up there. Father Thomas was kind enough to check hospital records in the city at the time, but nothing came up. No babies missing. Nothing that could be traced back to me. Tobe listened while studying the note. I tried to get a sense of what he was feeling, but all I got was curiosity, with a faint whiff of concern. What are you thinking? I asked. I feel you, but I can't exactly read you.
You will. Someday.
He winked at me.
Your empath ability is still very green. Once you develop it properly, and once you get a better understanding of emotions in general, you'll be able to identify and interpret everything with incredible accuracy. Tell me, Harley, do you remember anything from before the orphanage?
Nothing. I don't think so, anyway, I mumbled. Flashes of previous dreams rushing before my eyes. Tobe was quick to notice.
What is it?
He asked. I think I've had dreams about my parents. But they're too hazy, I confessed. When I dream, it's all clear, and it's like I know exactly what's going on, who I am, who they are. But the moment I open my eyes, I forget everything. I'm left with bright spots and the warmth of a smile.
Wait here,
Tobe said, then disappeared behind a glass box wall hosting 10 formless monsters. They rippled across the crystalline surface, then scattered at the bottom, and I could see Tobe on the other side, bent over a wooden chest. I glanced over to my left to find Ketsy still watching me curiously, the tip of its tail twitching. I can't believe I'm saying this, but you are creepy and gorgeous at the same time, I said, staring at the mythical serpent.
Thank you. I get that a lot,
Tobe quipped, coming back with what looked like a Native American dreamcatcher. No, I meant Ketsy, I replied, then worried he might feel offended somehow, which threw me into a most awkward stammer.
Not that you're not gorgeous. Well, not gorgeous, but, good looking. You are, despite the lion head. Not despite, sorry. It's not like there's something wrong with your head. It's perfect, just the way it is. And you're not creepy at all. I mean, stop me, please. I'm digging myself into a hole I won't be able to get out of. Tobe stared at me for a couple of seconds, then laughed. His laughter was strange, like a soft purr, his jaws open and his white fangs glistening. At least he had a sense of humor and wasn't easily offended. Thank heavens.
It's all right, Harley. Do not worry, he replied. I'm well aware that my appearance doesn't exactly match my nature or my vocabulary, or my ability to use a vocabulary. Here, take this.
He handed me the dreamcatcher, and I spent a good minute looking at it from all angles. It was really old, judging by the yellowed sinews used for the net. The edges were wrapped in worn red leather, and the feathers were simply stunning, each the size of my palm and bright red. They were quite peculiar, too, mainly because they looked a lot like peacock feathers, with big white and black eyes in the middle, but the coloring simply didn't feel natural. The beads were shiny and black, with tiny reddish striations. It was truly a beautiful piece. What does this do? I asked.
It's a dream catcher.
Of course it is, I said. He was stating the obvious, but I had a feeling our concepts of obvious were quite different. In human culture, dreamcatchers had lost their mystical origin and were simply regarded as beautiful Native American decorative objects. Something told me this wasn't just for decoration. I'm guessing it's magical?
Yes. It's a very old charm. Only a handful of these still exist. They were woven by Navajo warlocks before the first European settlers came to America,
Tobe explained.
All you need to do is hang it above your head before you go to sleep and say, Na'izesh. That's Navajo for dream. It will capture your dreams in vivid detail.
Oh, wow. I was floored by his gesture and by what this meant for me on a very personal level. This was a rare artifact, and Tobe was simply handing it over to me to help me remember my dreams. Who does that? Wonderful creatures do, Harley. Wonderful creatures. How can I ever repay you for this? I breathed, my eyes glassy with tears and my throat closing up.
Just look after it, Harley. Like I said, it is extremely rare and highly valuable. So be careful whom you tell about it.
Tobe smiled, and I nodded in response. Thank you, Tobe. Thank you so much. Wait, quick question. How do I see my dreams afterward? You said it captures them.
Oh, yes. Good question. It's a very intense experience. Much like taking peyote,
he replied, slightly amused. I've never...
Of course you haven't, and I don't think you should.
He shook his head vehemently.
It's a powerful hallucinogenic to humans, but to magicals, it is far, far more powerful, much more intense. It is a literal separation of consciousness and body. Some magicals even fail to return to their physical forms. But anyway, you'll learn that from Preceptor Belmore. She uses peyote in some of her charms and hexes. To see your dreams, you need only to hold the dreamcatcher with both hands and say, Yashtya. That means speak. And it allows the dreamcatcher to speak to you with the images from your dream. You'll see what I mean.
I nodded again, my gaze shifting repeatedly between Tobe and the dreamcatcher. I rarely got gifts, and never one of such importance. It felt humbling, and at the same time it filled me with an unfamiliar but warm light, as if I'd finally found my place in the world. The pragmatic side of me quickly kicked in.
reminding me not to get too attached. Tobe was clearly an extraordinary creature, but I'd yet to find the same appreciation for the rest of the coven. I had to take my time before giving the coven an answer, no matter what that answer may be.
Thank you, Tobe. I offered a warm smile, which he returned with a gentle expression.
Now go to sleep, Harley, he replied. You shouldn't be out at this hour anyway. You have a long day ahead tomorrow, don't you?
Yes, totally, I sighed. I'll see you tomorrow, then. I left Tobe in the bestiary and eventually found my way back to the dorms. It was going to take some time to get used to all the passageways and corridors in this place, not to mention all the floors. I'd only seen one today. From what I understood, there were five. And if they were as huge as this one, I would need a couple of days just to visit them all. By the time I reached my room, my eyes were already droopy, and my brain had slowed down, to the point where I had a hard time remembering the Navajo words Tobe had told me to use for my dreamcatcher. Crap, I muttered, then tucked the dreamcatcher into the bottom drawer of my nightstand. I'd find a better hiding place tomorrow. I couldn't even stand anymore, my arms and legs weighing a ton. I was far too tired to struggle to remember the words. I'll ask Tobe again tomorrow, I murmured, resting my head on my pillow. My mind went back into overdrive as I remembered the gargoyle attacks. Maybe a minute later, however, I let the darkness embrace me, closing my eyes and finally drifting away.
Stay safe. Stay smart, baby girl.
That voice. I knew it. I was slipping into a dream, and with my last sliver of semi-consciousness, I made a mental note to ask Tobe to write down those Navajo incantations tomorrow. I needed to see the face of the man that voice belonged to. Chapter 18. A knock on the door made my eyes snap open. Sunshine poured through the windows. I'd left the thick dark green curtains open. Only then, after a heavy sleep, did I take in the colors of my room. Dark green on the windows and carpeted floor, and walnut paneling on the walls, with matching furniture. I was so tired yesterday, so overwhelmed, I didn't even notice the mid-century vibe. It didn't match the rest of the coven, and I had a feeling it was decorated by the previous magical, as the furnishings sort of matched the 1950s movie posters. A second knock made me sit up. Yeah, I called out, readjusting to consciousness. It's Astrid. Can I come in? I blinked several times. The memory of yesterday coming back in full color. Man, I was knocked out last night. I couldn't remember a single dream. Come to think of it, I could barely remember how I got back from the bestiary. Yeah, sure, I replied, pulling the blanket aside. My jeans and t-shirt were still on. It was a miracle I'd made it out of my boots last night. The door opened, and in came Astrid, dragging a solid metal clothes rack with her, the wheels squeaking a little too loudly. It was loaded with a plethora of clothes, with a bottom rack on which several boxes wobbled as she stopped in the middle of the room. What in the world? I murmured, getting out of bed and rubbing my eyes. Astrid put on a presentation pose, beaming as she pointed at the rack. These are all for you. Compliments of the San Diego Coven, she said. Upon closer inspection, I realized that all the clothes were in my size. All my favorite brands and styles, in a variety of whites, blues, and reds, mostly, along with a couple of leather jackets. She opened the boxes one by one. Boots, biker style, ankle height, and not too heavy on the soles. Just the way I liked my footwear, as well as a pair of sneakers. Astrid? What's all this? I managed, when she opened one last box, which was filled with lingerie and a bag of essential girly stuff, shampoo, conditioner, personal hygiene, and makeup. All my regular brands. How did they know?
Wait. My apartment.
Well, after the gargoyle attack last night, there wasn't much left that we could salvage from your apartment, Astrid explained, taking one of the leather jackets and turning it over to get a better look at the metallic accents. Judging by the look on her face, she liked it.
I don't...
What? I was still quite confused. The gargoyles trashed the place, and I don't mean just the broken water pipe and windows. No, that was me, I replied, replaying the entire scene in my mind. Ah, okay. Cool. She nodded, slightly amused. You really need an esprit, girl. She chuckled, then switched back to serious-looking Astrid. Thing is, one of the gargoyles flipped over the TV, then pulled out and tore some of the live wires in the wall. I'm quite fuzzy on the details right now. Bottom line, your place burned down. A little.
What?
My jaw dropped. My heart sank. I could almost cry, but after what I'd seen happen to Daisy, the apartment didn't seem like the worst part of my encounter with the beasts. There was a fire. The sprinkler system was set off eventually, but most of your stuff was scorched, and everything else was soaked. Your place is a mess. Sorry, but I think you'll be staying here for more than a day or two. Astrid offered me a sympathetic smile. A couple of seconds went by as I did a quick assessment in the back of my head. The place is insured, I remembered. The lease covers accidents and stuff. Pretty sure it covers fires. I think I'll be okay. I won't lose my lease. I got a 3-month deposit on that place. Don't worry about that. We're the cleanup crew. We'll take care of that, too. She winked, then pointed at the wardrobe. Do you like it? Yeah, I do. A lot, actually. How did you know my size and stuff? She hesitated, offering me the jacket. I took it, briefly looked at it, then left it on my bed. I didn't like the silence coming off her. She was hiding something. I could feel it. There was a lot of awkwardness coming from her, too. Too much for me to handle pre-coffee. Astrid, how did you know? I asked again, adding a bit more gravitas to my voice. I didn't. Wade did.
Huh?
Wade bought all this? Astrid said, her voice barely audible. I looked at the wardrobe again, then moved closer to get a better view of the lingerie box and... Oh my God, there is so... much... black lace. Everything? I managed, staring at the bundle of bras and panties with various lace designs, all worthy of artistic praise. They were all high-end creations, the kind of stuff I couldn't afford, but would have loved to wear, especially if I ever met a special someone. At some point. This was so private, so intimate. I was stunned, flustered, and a little creeped out. It was as if someone had peeked into my mind, plucking out my most hidden sartorial desires and turning them into reality. Yeah, I heard Astrid's reply as I bent down and noticed my favorite shampoo and conditioner set, Freesia and Jasmine. You're telling me that Wade went out this morning and bought all this for me? I turned to face her, still having trouble processing the information. She sighed, then nodded, her lips pressed into a thin line. I didn't even know until they were delivered to Kid City. Some of the parents who had kids playing there looked a little confused, but... Anyway, yeah. I mean, he used the Coven card, though. He didn't pay out of his own pocket or anything. How did he know to buy all this? I mean, these are all my size. My style. Even my favorite brands. This is weird. Or creepy. I'm not sure which, I blurted, and Astrid chuckled, which further befuddled me. How come you aren't creeped out? Oh, honey, I've been here for too long to be creeped out by something as innocent and frankly as cute as this, she replied. Wade is a very special kind of guy. He pays a lot of attention to details, even when you think he's not. Christmas has been amazing since he came into the coven. He's in charge of the gifts every year because he just knows everybody's tastes. He won't tell us how he does it, though. It's his secret, he says. Okay, so I'm not the only one he's creeped out like this, I said. Come on, don't be so hard on the guy. That's just Wade. It doesn't mean anything, if you ask me. Though I've never seen him buy lingerie for anyone. That's a first. Astrid giggled, then checked her watch,
Shoot, breakfast is ready. Hurry up, get dressed, and I'll meet you in the banquet hall. She didn't wait for a reply as she rushed out, leaving me with my wonderful wardrobe, handpicked and purchased by Wade freaking Crowley. After 20 minutes spent gawking at the rack and then a quick shower, I slipped into some of the new clothes, opting for jeans, a smart cotton shirt, and the leather jacket I'd left on the bed. My face was on fire when I put on the lingerie, and I struggled to ignore the thrills when I saw how perfectly it fit me, how every black band hugged my form and brought out my curves. I put on a pair of boots, then slapped on some BB cream and brushed my bright red mane. After a week of absolute weirdness and two near-death experiences, I had to admit, I looked great. I had always felt comfortable in my own skin, though I often tried to stay invisible, unnoticeable. But I'd already gotten used to the fact that there was only so much I could do to hide my natural features. My hair was long, soft, and straight, reaching just below my shoulder blades. The tips curled up when the humidity was higher than usual. My eyes were sky blue, and I often wondered whether I'd gotten them from my mom or my dad. The same question applied to the sprinkle of freckles on my nose. I was taller than the average girls in my age bracket, which was why I often chose flat soles, so as not to stand out even more. After about 10 minutes of getting lost in those humongous hallways, I finally found the banquet hall, with its pristine white tables and silverware. There was a huge breakfast buffet at the end, loaded with a variety of pastries, fresh fruit, coffee and tea, pancakes, basically breakfast heaven, complete with 3 types of maple syrup. I scanned the room, looking for my rag team. My eyes met Finch's, and the hairs on the back of my neck stood up at attention. I offered a brief scowl, then found Garrett at the same table, along with Poe and the rest of the investigative team. After another minute, I eventually found Astrid, Santana, Tatiana, Dylan, Raff, and Wade at the opposite end of the same long table, with 1 spare seat. My heart warmed up a little, thinking they'd actually saved it for me. Aw. I glided through the hall, taking deep breaths as all the magical emotions started licking at my senses like silent but nagging flames. I made it to the buffet, making sure to ignore everyone around me and in my path. My hope was that if I avoided eye contact, somehow my empathy wouldn't be so intense. With slightly shaking hands, I managed to pour myself a cup of coffee with 3 sugars, then loaded a plate with a pastry and some red berries. I wasn't too hungry, but I figured I had a long day ahead. Carbs were welcome. I counted to 100 in my head as I made my way to my team's side of the table. Anxiousness, anger, jealousy, curiosity, frantic heartbeats, and affection, fear, and concern. These were all the overall vibe of the coven that morning. Every magical had something to worry or be thrilled about, and it was all piling up on top of my already frayed nerves. I needed to eat really quickly and get out of here.
"You made it,"
Santana greeted me with a smile, then nodded at the empty chair.
"Sit, eat. Take it easy."
"Take it easy," I chuckled softly. "Easier said than done." Wade watched me quietly, measuring me from head to toe, most likely assessing his shopping skills on me, the live model. His gaze darkened as it wandered up and down, before he looked right into my eyes for a second. My heart skipped a beat. Without so much as a hello, he shifted his focus back to Astrid.
"Alton said he'll bring over the assignments this morning," he told her,
while I sat down and chose to focus on his emotions, since everybody else was so freaking loud and everywhere in my soul. He was tense. His self-control was spectacular, since there was something akin to a storm brewing inside, a raw state that I didn't recognize. There was a pang in my stomach, which I attributed to hunger, so I mowed through my breakfast and washed it down with coffee.
"Do we know what we're doing first?" Astrid replied, while Santana watched me, amusement twinkling in her brown eyes.
"Probably Park West cleanup. That's a priority," Wade replied.
My heart was beating a little faster than usual, but given the number of people surrounding me, it was becoming difficult to ascertain whether it was my feelings or someone else's.
I'd never been so out of control as an empath. Nights spent in the casino had taught me to master the self-control part, and yet the coven made it extremely difficult to hold it all together. Or maybe I was still tired, even overwhelmed by the previous day's events. My Daisy.
So, sleep well?
Santana asked, ignoring the cleanup conversation. Like a log, I replied, then took another sip of coffee. The food was settling nicely in my stomach, but something was still tugging at me on the inside. That's not me, for sure. I looked at Wade, persistently even, but he refused to acknowledge me. Santana was quick to catch on.
Did something happen?
She asked, somewhat amused. Nope, all good. Weird good, but good. For the most part, anyway. You know, after we set aside the facts that my car and my place were trashed by...
Not another word.
Wade cut in, gritting his teeth and giving me a deadly glare.
Whoa.
Oh, yeah, right. Sorry. I remembered the secrecy part about the triple gargoyle incident, as per Tobe's request. I didn't show any remorse, though. Not while Wade's eyes were still on me. There was something a little too sharp, too rough about Wade this morning. Something that contradicted the kind, though slightly creepy, gesture of buying me a whole new wardrobe. He clearly had no intention of making a habit of being nice. So I considered it a slip, and switched back to treating him with the same abrasiveness that he showed toward me. Thank you for the lingerie, Wade, I said, barely recognizing myself. The man had an ego, and I was ready to take a stab at it. The coffee was kicking in. Wade's forehead smoothed, a muscle flexing nervously in his jaw as he continued to glare at me, this time for a much different reason. It was hard to keep a grin from slitting my face in that moment, but I managed nonetheless. My remark was enough to draw the attention of the entire rag team. Astrid chuckled, and for a moment was the target of Wade's deadly scowl. She hid her face in her coffee mug in an attempt to stifle her amusement.
Is that what you mean by weird but good? Santana grinned. Wade Crowley buying you intimates? Did he get the bra size right?
Santana.
Wade's tone was flat and filled with warning, but she was anything but bothered. I was in for a treat.
Wade, she shot back, mimicking his tone. Is there something you wish to share with the class?
Nope,
he said. It was his turn to hide his face in his coffee mug, but there was no amusement coming from him. Just burning embarrassment. It struck a nerve, as he'd probably expected me to stay quiet about the whole lingerie thing. In your dreams, Crowley.
So, Harley, Santana said, smiling at me. Did he get the size right?
Santana.
Wade tried again, trying so hard to be polite.
He did.
Perfect fit, I replied, trying so hard to keep a straight face. Wade's turmoil was delicious, and it seemed like fair pay for my flustered morning. The intention may have been noble, but seriously, you don't just buy a girl that kind of lingerie right after you call her mediocre. Magical pun intended.
Don't be alarmed, Dylan chimed in, grinning. Wade's gift-buying skill is out of this world.
Yeah, I told her the same thing, Astrid added, and Wade seemed to relax a little, while Tatiana and Raph watched with straight faces. Nothing to be, you know, creeped out about. Wade just knows us a little too well, without actually knowing us.
Has he bought you any black lace lingerie?
I asked Astrid, not ready to let Wade off the hook just yet. I made her blush as she shook her head. I then looked at Dylan. Did he get you a perfectly fitted jockstrap by any chance?
Oh, hell no,
Dylan burst out, then stilled when a heavy hand landed on his shoulder. Attached to said hand was Alton Waterhouse, freshly shaved and fitted into an elegant dark gray suit, complete with his dragon head cufflinks. His esprit. Fun's over. And just like that, Wade could finally breathe again. I caught a glimpse of Tatiana smiling, and that was a first, given her otherwise icy demeanor. Only then did I realize how hard she was laughing on the inside, as was Raph. Good. At least they got some early entertainment before the workday begins.
Good morning, team, Alton said,
then dropped a file on the table before Wade.
I have your assignments for the day. I kindly ask that you and the investigative team